Welcome to The Sync Report, the intersection between filmmakers, content creators, and musicians, where we host a weekly conversation with some of the biggest names in film, television, music, and entertainment. Meet industry experts and top-level musicians as we pull the curtain back on music placement and scores, building vital relationships and providing real opportunities for our listeners. Listen to indie filmmakers and content creators present their latest productions and describe specific scenes as they consider music submitted by our audience. Hosted by film star and musician Colin O'Donoghue and his co-host, the godmother of independent films, Rose Ganguza, and The Sync Report's creator and music supervisor, Jason P. Rothbury. Don't forget, tell your friends about us and remember to rate, comment, and subscribe to The Sync Report on Apple and across all platforms. Music is the difference between a good film and a great one. And I have no idea what's on today's show. And to be honest, I'm not really motivated to find out either at £4 an hour.
Welcome to The Sync Report.
Thank you, Milfredo and Willow, for that lovely introduction. And welcome to The Sync Report. So, ladies and gentlemen, let's welcome Rose to the stage. Rose, how are you? How are things?
Doing good. We're having our big St. Patrick's Day parade in New York, the largest in the world. Did you know
well,
that?
Well, I was down at a St. Patrick's Day. I did.
Larger than Dublin?
I think it is larger than Dublin, although
yeah,
Dublin this year today was a pretty huge parade.
So everybody on the street is drunk?
Well, I currently have a green t-shirt on in honor
okay,
of it.
Okay, there you go.
I am not drunk. So you guys, hope you guys are on St. Patrick's Day.
Loser. Me, on the other hand, I'm eyeball deep already. Oh, we're going crazy in Kenmare.
Yeah. A big party. Yeah, I can well imagine.
It's been going since breakfast time. Me, the deers, and my dog.
There you go.
Yeah, we're all dressed in green. And yeah, I went with Jameson today because it's in a green bottle.
Okay, there you go.
Oh, good. Good.
We
can have an extra one for me then.
Yes.
So they go from pub to pub.
A pub crawl.
They actually have a map. So you can find your way from one pub to another.
Oh my God, that's hysterical.
Oh wow.
That's just a standard Friday night where I come from.
That is.
Yeah, I did feel today like it was the first time in 2 years that I've actually felt like things were back to normal was at the parade today. So it was
there you go.
A pretty great experience. And it was a beautiful day.
Oh, did you go to the parade?
I went to the parade in Drogheda, not in Dublin,
amazing.
Which is not the biggest parade in the world, but it's a decent parade.
Yeah, because last year the parade was turned into a caravan, right? It was like all cars because they couldn't, because of social distancing. Were they able to actually do the official parade?
Yeah, they had an official parade today and everybody was out celebrating. It was fantastic.
That sounds
so
great.
Cool.
Did everybody wear a Kiss Me Irish t-shirt?
No, we're pretty much all Irish, so nobody be able to watch the parade. Everybody be too busy kissing.
Ooh, I want to hang out with that family.
Oh dear.
All right. Sorry.
On that note. Well, Rose, I hope you enjoy the rest of the St. Patrick's Day.
Making corned beef and cabbage and soda bread right now.
Oh,
beautiful. Good. Hopefully a Guinness or two on top of that.
I'm glad you're here. So grab a drink. Let's have a conversation about music and sing. Oh.
Let's welcome our producer, Paula Flack, to the stage.
Paula,
how are you?
Hi, Colin. Hello. I'm good, thanks. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. Paula, how have you been and what's happening with you?
I've been good, thanks. Do you want to hear what I've done this week? I went to see Mars.
I would love to hear what
you've done. At the Natural History Museum.
Oh, wow.
It's an art installation by an artist called Luke Jerram, and he makes these giant 7-meter, I keep wanting to say inflatables, but they're not inflatables, sculptures, and he's done one of Mars for Mars Week. And,
oh, wow. That sounds great.
Very Jeff Bezos.
And we saw the moon. Earlier this year.
It sounds like it was a great week. But how about you tell us who's on the show this week?
I can do that. We have Daniel Sackheim on the show this week, Colin. Emmy Award-winning film and TV director and producer Daniel Sackheim is best known for his more recent work on global hit TV shows such as Game of Thrones, True Detective, and Ozark, for which he received a Best Director Emmy nomination for their episode Tonight We Improvise. Daniel's career in film began with film editing and the good fortune to be mentored by acclaimed filmmakers including John Cassavetes and Michael Mann. Daniel began directing for TV in the 90s on shows including Law and Order, NYPD Blue, and the cult classic The X-Files. He has gone on to direct some of the biggest shows on TV in the last 20 years, including The Walking Dead, Game of Thrones, True Detective, Ozark, and Better Call Saul, as well as M. Night Shyamalan's The Servant, The First, starring Sean Penn, HBO's The Leftovers, and The Man in the High Castle, plus an episode of one of my favourite TV shows, Chicago Fire. As well as his extensive work in TV, Daniel directed the Sony feature film The Glass House, starring Lily Sobieski, Diane Lane, and Stellan Skarsgård, and produced the X-Files movie Fight the Future. And that's not all. In addition to his work as a director, Daniel has executive produced or produced a number of critically acclaimed TV series, including The Americans, HBO's Emmy-winning show Lovecraft Country, which incidentally won an Emmy for its score and was nominated for an Emmy for music supervision, Amazon's Jack Ryan, Life, starring Damian Lewis, and House MD, starring another of my favourite shows. In 2020, Daniel co-founded Bedrock Entertainment with award-winning producer Tony Toe in a joint venture with ITV Studios America. Bedrock Entertainment works with great storytellers to create premium content for today's global audiences. And I'm not sure how he finds the time, but Daniel is also a passionate photographer, and I'm sure we'll be talking about this as well. So let's welcome Daniel Sackheim to the show.
Daniel!
Woo! Welcome, Daniel. Welcome to the Sync Report.
That was such a beautiful introduction, and it's all downhill from here, but I had hoped not to make you wait because I can't figure out how to do something as anything beyond operate a tea kettle. Anyway, apologies. Right.
Well, welcome to the Sync Report, Daniel. We're so excited to have you on and can't wait to hear about your incredible career. But I guess I want to start, I'm going to start, if that's okay with you. And I'd like to go back to your younger years for a moment, if I could. So would we all. But I'd like to know a little bit about your music tastes as a teen and to see if they sort of aligned with the shows you later became involved with.
Yeah, you know, it sort of runs the gamut of, you know, a David Bowie and Led Zeppelin and Elton John, you know, all of whom I was fortunate enough to see in concert in their heyday. You know, who else would be on that list? The Who, you know, I mean, kind of what people today call classic rock or what old people listen to.
I qualify as
so,
that.
Yeah, well, I qualify as that too. But and did that kind of, do you think that your taste in music kind of aligned with the type of show that you were sort of later to become involved with? Or,
well, what's interesting, or maybe not so interesting, but more in terms of, you know, right place, right time. The second job that I did as a producer was on Miami Vice in the third and fourth season. And I was an associate producer on it and the music supervisor. You know, the beginning of my career sort of coincided with this notion of integrating popular music with television. And it was inspired by, just a little inside information, it was the idea of, do you guys by any chance remember there were these Michelob ads that were all shot at night and they were like really sexy? Right. And there was MTV. Right. So the pitch I remember for the show was it's a Michelob commercial mixed with MTV cops. I never saw a Michelob bottle. And I honestly, I don't know from that, they arrived at Miami Vice. But I was there sort of at the beginning of that kind of merger of, you know, of popular music working in concert with a visual narrative to communicate story and to sort of elevate the, you know, the genre, the cop genre, I guess, really, but television overall, right? Now we take it for granted. You know, if you're not finding a way to integrate songs into a show, then you're probably, well, you're probably shooting a Magnum PI or Matlock or something, assuming that they brought them back. But that's, I think that's the idea. That's kind of how I combine those two loves, you know, in my earlier days.
Mm-hmm. And oh my God, did he do it so perfectly well on Miami Vice. I mean, that really kind of was, you mentioned the Michelob commercials, but to me, it was that series, you know, the combination of, you know, that action, they were gorgeous, the fashion, the cars, Miami, sexy, sexy, sexy. And then the music, you know, it's just, yeah it was brilliant.
I mean, no one would probably remember this today, but it was also this idea of launching songs. You know, that was, a number of recording artists, they premiered their music on Miami Vice.
Wow.
So cool.
So Dan, you know, when you were coming up in TV, there was a really big divide between television people and film people. And now that line is blurred considerably because film directors are now doing television or a hybrid version of television and vice versa. So tell me a little bit about your trajectory in this business. Was your first love photography? Was it, you know, how did you get to where you eventually got directing and then producing as well? Give us a little bit of background on that.
So beyond dumb luck, you want something more precise?
Well, no, dumb luck leads us everywhere. But
true, right?
I think the question I always get asked is, you know, oh, how do you do what you did? And it's just such root to it. And sometimes you're doing everything and then it leads to one place eventually.
You know, I wasn't one of those people that knew from an early age that they wanted to be a storyteller, a filmmaker. I was in engineering school, actually, and only because I think I always had a love of process, how things are made, what is the thought that goes into any creative venture. And just at that point was, I guess the creative venture was composed of electrons and neutrons and, you know, how things worked. And I realized probably about 9 months in that I wasn't cut out for it. And so I dropped out of school. I thought, I was a bit of an introvert. And I thought, you know, maybe what would help me is to take acting classes, right? Because if I can't be comfortable, maybe I could act comfortably. And I just sort of fell in love with it. Not that I ever thought that I could be an actor, but I sort of fell in love with the process and, you know, the love of good material and point of view. How do you bring your own point of view to material? You know, why, if you saw, a Pinter play done, you know, by five different directors over time, why would they all be different? And I was sort of fascinated by that. My father, who was not fascinated by me being fascinated by it, he was fascinated that I no longer had a paying job. And as he was paying for college.
Not fascinated in the good way.
Yeah, he was fascinated with my fascination, not fascinated by the fact that I was freeloading when I was like 21. So I got a job doing pretty much all you can do with a year of engineering school, which is sort of fixed stuff. And I ended up getting a job by happenstance at a company that was located in Burbank, California, that produced, you know, Super Bowl. We're talking about really awful, cheap, local spot. Nonetheless, it was kind of a good training ground because I befriended some editors there who taught me functionally, you know, how you cut stuff together. And I kind of fell in love with the idea of telling stories. My father at the time was friendly with a woman by the name of Margaret Booth, who had been a very famous film editor, if a film editor can be famous, but notable in that she had, you know, edited Mutiny on Bounty and Camille and, you know, a lot of these big MGM classic films. And she was in her 80s at the time. And she was now editing, you know, all those adaptations of the Neil Simon plays, California Suite or Goodbye Girl. And she took me under her wing. She made me an apprentice film editor. And I will never forget my first job.
Were you working like on a flatbed in those days, or were you?
Not yet. Well, it was a moviola in those days.
It was a moviola. Okay.
But my introduction to working with her was famous film director. It was John Huston. And there was, at the time, there was an AFI celebration of his life. And so she was tasked with editing together this presentation reel. So for a week, we sat in a screening room watching 2 to 3 John Huston movies a day, and I was taking notes. That was the beginning of my career and my film school, because I never went to film school. And I thought, this is pretty cool. I can't believe I'm getting paid to do this. As it turned out, I also was getting paid later on to wash her car, pick up her dry cleaning, and grocery shopping. But nonetheless, I learned a lot from her, and I think that's also how I started to get a grasp of filmic storytelling, how movies are put together, how you tell a narrative, what makes for an interesting scene, what makes for a compelling scene, what makes for a not confusing scene, right? In terms of how you can.
But that's such an amazing skill, Dan, to have, to go into directing, because a lot of directors do not have that ability, and it shows, you know.
I'm so you started
in the right place.
You know, I don't actually, it's hard for me to fathom actually how someone directs without a good knowledge of the nature of it, because when I would go on set to shoot a scene, I would construct the scene in my head. I knew what my point of view was, and I knew how it was going to be put together.
And you weren't waiting.
A byproduct of my years in editorial.
Right.
Have I put anybody to sleep yet?
No.
Okay.
But you know, another thing, John, which is interesting, because you were working with a woman editor. What a lot of people don't realize that even from the beginning of film, one of the jobs in filmmaking that where women did kind of shine was editing, and it had to do with the cutting of film, and it just sort of stuck.
Really?
Because we have
look at
all the great women editors that are out there, including Scorsese's editor.
Oh, Thelma Schumacher.
Whole life, yeah.
Yeah.
Thelma.
Margaret Booth started cutting film in the late 20s.
It was because women's hands were small, and they were, it was like sewing, you know? It was like putting things together and not making a mistake.
So then I guess you guys have by this point figured out that I have diminutive hands.
Yeah.
I wasn't going to say anything, but guilty. Incredible. And, you know, obviously, you know, now your career path is like growing. You know, you're working on Annie Stripes. You worked on one of my favorite all-time movies, The Toy. But I want to ask you specifically about the Alfred Hitchcock reboot, Alfred Hitchcock Presents. And getting a chance to work with Tim Burton. So you're like, you seem to be penetrating like the greats in the industry at an early stage. And something we talk a lot about on our show, because we, you know, we're talking to indie filmmakers, indie songwriters, is about networking and building relationships. So I'm just wondering how, you know, you went about, you know, obviously from Margaret and then moving on to these other like massive projects and directors. A, was it intimidating? Did you feel intimidated at any point? And B, you know, with these relationships that you were focused on building, knowing that these were where you would get your next job?
I don't think I was intimidated. I think I was just probably too stupid to be intimidated. I mean, I'm not sure that I really understood who it was that I was meeting. I'm sorry. I will give you an exception to the too stupid part. Not that I wasn't too stupid, but even being as stupid as I was, I realized who I was working with. And there was an episode that was directed by Christopher Crowe, and Miles Davis did the original music. So we sat in this was back in the day, you used to have screening rooms. Everyone didn't sit at home watching stuff on their television set and make notes. You ran it together in a screening room where you would spot the music. And in this case, we were spotting the music with Miles Davis. Now, my father, who was a screenwriter, was also an amateur jazz pianist and really, really good. So an early indoctrination to jazz was part of my life. Miles Davis and Bill Evans and, the gamut, right? So I well knew who Miles Davis was because I think I had like a worn out copy of So What sitting on my shelf at home. That was a really cool moment.
Yeah, I have to say, I got a chance to work with Quincy once, and oh my God, is absolutely the coolest human that walks the planet.
Yeah, it's really, I mean, when you think about their artistry, right, their skill and their talents, but how hard life was made for these artists as well, right?
Yeah, no, when he came up
to get to where they did, it's impressive. It makes you feel, well, it should make you feel really grateful about how lucky some of the more privileged of us are.
Yeah, I just saw a documentary on Sidney Poitier, and it was just like, because, you know, Quincy did a lot of work with, the odds these guys came up against and still, like, you know, came across so cool and so heartfelt and creative just astounds me.
Did you see the Miles Davis documentary, Jace?
Yes,
the one
I did.
It's just come out. It's amazing.
Incredible. Really incredible. Yeah.
Dan, I wanted to ask you, you know, looking back on the shows and stuff that you've been involved with over the years, you know, you could say that there's a kind of a love of almost like film noir. Do you think that came from maybe possibly working on the Alfred Hitchcock series that you first kind of realized that you loved the film noir genre?
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I don't tend to think of that series as so much film noir. I mean, I think of those as like reality tales.
Was that a genre that you were interested in, do you think, before that, or did it just
I think I got interested in it when I think I saw 56 Pickup or something like that, and Kubrick started out his career doing a movie called The Killers. Mm-hmm. Which
was amazing.
I'm sorry, The Killer, which with Sterling Hayden, which doesn't really look anything like his other movies, but it's considered noir. And I think I just fell in love with the style and the threat, the clear heroes and villains of it. Yeah, I to this day, I really do love it.
And Sterling, one of my favorite actors. Oh my God, I've been watching his Westerns lately. Oh my God, this guy was genius.
But also Kubrick was a photographer like you.
Yeah,
a great photographer.
A great photographer.
He developed his eye.
Dan, so up working in film editing, and we're just kind of curious how you ended up doing music supervision on Miami Vice. We touched on that a little bit, but
this is a great
segue
story
between film editing and music supervision.
So I had been working on Hitchcock Presents, and the show was canceled. My wife and I at the time were newly married, so I was a little panicked about where my next paycheck was coming from. I mean, that was really my first meaningful job, being other than an editor. So it happened that someone knew Michael Mann and made an introduction. before me. I couldn't even tell you who that was at this point, but I went in to meet Michael Mann. So at the time, they were just finishing up season two of Miami Vice, which was already now a big hit. And so I go to see Michael Mann, and he's in this office that is all black. It's black rug, black wallpaper, black ceiling.
Oh, God.
And wow. The singular point of focus in the room is this desk, a big lacquer desk that is the Miami Vice colors, you know, the sort of the rich turquoise and pastels, right?
That Miami.
And it's illuminated from above with a single spotlight. So you feel like you're walking into the mouth of hell. And there's Mike Mann sitting behind his desk, floating in the center of the room. Was the nicest possible guy to me. Good to meet you. Don't really have anything right now, but maybe in the future, get the fuck out. But in the most pleasant way. Anyway, a week later, I get a call. And the associate producer by the name of Fred Lyle, who really should get all the credit for the musical choices at the beginning of Miami Vice, had left the show to go work with Anton Yurkovich, who was the guy who had really created Miami Vice, had written the pilot script, and was now going off to do a show called, I believe, Spy Game or something like that. I mean, it's that notable that I think it was on for like episodes and never saw the light of day again. Fred Lyle went to work with him. Well, Michael Mann called me back in. I had another meeting and he said, so we need an associate producer. And I think I said, I'm something like, I'm your man. And he said, oh, and this person has to be a qualified music supervisor. Can you do that job? Which quite clearly I could not. And
so you had never music supervised before this?
Oh, no. I mean, I was a guy who, you know, would smoke a joint, listen to Led Zeppelin and stuff.
Oh, I got to be this guy's best friend.
Right. And so he said, can you do that? And without hesitation, I said, fuck yeah, with no clue how to do it. And really, it was the first show by any measure that was doing this. So it wasn't like I could call up my 15 music supervisor friends, right? There was no Liza Richardson around. There was no anyone who could tell me what to do. So I would do my sort of post-production work during the course of the day. And back then, everything was on vinyl, sort of like it's coming back to now, right? Everything comes back. And all the music labels would send in piles and piles of records. And so I would then begin my evening, which revolved around just listening to as many new tracks as I could muster and, you know, going to a screening room and watching scenes and working with the editors and trying to come up with music ideas. And the blessing here actually was that...
Dan, were you free... Were you just free to go through these songs and like choose? Or did the director?
No, it didn't so much work that way. I mean, it worked that I would make suggestions, or I would work with the editors, and they would then cut a scene to a piece of music. They all had ideas themselves. They were all really into it, and then it would usually like three choices. This is usually how it works even today.
Yeah,
and then. Two or three choices would go to Michael, and either he would accept one of them or reject all of them, and we would start over.
Keep working. Yeah.
That was kind of the process.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I was just grateful that I wasn't fired, you know, 15 minutes after taking the job. So,
Dan, you had one of your favorite song placements on that show, White Rabbit by Jefferson Airplane. Can you describe the scene and how that came about?
Sure. I mean, it's not really a great clip. In other words, it's not... the term is scorse, or the term was scorse then. I don't know if people still use that term. In this case, it was really... it was about a... There was an interview that Tubbs and Crockett were doing of a doctor at like a veterans ward. You know, remember back then we were still dealing with, you know, Vietnam vets who were struggling. So I was looking for anything that sort of felt reminiscent of movies, things that I had seen in like movies by Oliver Stone or what have you, like, you know, Inagata De Vita and White Rabbit has always conjured these images for me of not just, you know, getting high, but that it feels really connected to, you know, to that place, to Vietnam.
Yeah.
And anyway, that's really the simple answer in terms of
right. That
was the choice of that song.
Dan, can I ask you one more question before I pass this to Colin? In those days, at the time of, were these kind of rights as prohibitive as they are now? It would be really hard for any network production to get the rights to without Spotify
song.
Or stuff like that.
It's really funny you would ask me that, because as I was listening to this, I was thinking exactly the same thing. I mean, you know, unless you're like Euphoria, it probably has a bottomless music budget.
Yes.
Well, it was the first, right? It was really early in the process. And I don't think anyone knew whether or not this would catch on.
Yeah.
So my recollection is that it was fairly negotiable.
Because they were looking for the promotion for the song.
Personally, for the sync and publishing, right?
Publishing,
it certainly was. Even accounting for the, you know, value of money over time, it was certainly vastly less than it would cost today. Right. I can only imagine one song today would be $100,000 if it was a penny.
Even today, if I wanted to put White Rabbit in a film, it would cost me like my whole music budget.
Isn't it fascinating and cool that these great classic songs that are 50 years old are still topical and being used in contemporary narratives? I think that's
certainly. Yeah, and I think all the younger directors that I love and I work with, what they have in common is a great knowledge of music from that era. It's crazy, but they all know it because it is so special.
So
Dan, I sort of wanted to skip on a little bit if I could. You know, you were music supervising and associate producing on Miami Vice, and so how did you take the step then to directing?
One of the head writers on Miami Vice at the time was a guy whose name you may have heard of called Dick Wolf. Dick Wolf is the creator of Law and Order and all the various
Chicago shows.
Chicago PD.
Loads of my favorite shows.
He was famed for... He was a former ad man. It was often said of him he could sell ice to an Eskimo. So anyway, I worked with him on a number of projects that you more than likely never heard of and never seen in reruns. But Law and Order was one of the very first pilots that he made, and it was passed on by everyone in the world. And so he asked me to come in and help him post-produce that pilot. And then it didn't get an order. And then we went on, we did a bunch of these other series, short-lived series. Then about 2 years after it was shot, we shot a new pilot with a new network. Given my relationship with him and with the other producers on the show, they asked me if I had any interest in directing. And I said, yeah, probably not. I went home and my wife said, what did you say? Like, why would you say that? And so I went back the next day and said, I'm sorry, I thought you said genuflecting. I didn't, know that you meant genuflecting. directing. So I said, yeah, I would love to. That one episode that I seem to have some ability. What's the word I'm looking for? I didn't fuck it up. How about that? And so they asked me if I wanted to do another one. And one thing sort of led to the next. And eventually I went off and just started to freelance direct. I ended up meeting Greg Hoblit, who had then a producer and pilot director on NYPD Blue. And he offered me an episode of that, really when nobody else was hiring me for anything. And so I directed that. And then I went off to do another episode of a series that shall remain nameless up in New Mexico. And I had a really bad experience on that show. And one night, after being screamed at by the president of Universal Television for going over budget, I called my wife and I said, I'm out. You know, I'm not going to be able to work anymore. And
oh, my God.
Rest, and we're going to scale back. That was my intention. And then the very next morning at 6 a.m., I got a call from Greg Hoblit to say that I had been nominated for an Emmy.
Oh, my God.
There's a series of these events that kept sort of screaming at me, this is what you're meant to do. And you know, I did. And I was both really fortunate to do work that was good enough to get invited back and to build relationships. But also, I was very cognizant of something that my father had always said to me, which is only do good work. Good work begets more good work, which begets a healthier understanding of what you do. And this is sort of where I got picky. And being picky, you know, it makes you lucky in the end result because you're doing good work that, or you're working on good shows. Let me rephrase that. You're working on good shows, which then prompts people to, you know, offer you other good shows. So
what I keep picturing, Colin? I'm sorry. You know what I keep picturing, Colin Rose, is as Dan's traveling this journey, you know, in those early 70s cartoons, you have the angel and the devil on the shoulder, right?
Yeah.
I'm wondering, Dan, was it your father on your shoulder? Did you find inspiration from, you know, his fascination, you know, speaking to you, like, you know, and maybe you're feeling a little pressure, like, oh no, you know, I can't not be working. I'm just wondering if that's, it seems like your father was quite inspirational to you.
Yeah, he was, but it also might be more like Wile E. Coyote is always reaching out to try to capture the Roadrunner, and he always fails, but he always manages to come back, and like, or he'll get struck by lightning, right? And then you'll see him, he's charred black, and then he disintegrates like into ash, but then somehow, you know, and with his, you know, and when he's being struck by lightning, you see the skeleton under him.
So I
would go through that experience of hating the experience. And then, and yet somehow Wile E. Coyote is alive and well in the next scene.
Yeah.
More like that.
I'm interested in this because, you know, having worked on I did 6 years on a TV show for ABC and worked on another one then for Disney Plus for 6 months. I did 6 months in it. And, you know, I think it's interesting for people to know what the experience and what the creative goal is for a TV director, because I think, you know, sometimes people might not be as familiar with what it's like being, and, you know, listening to you talk about that experience in New Mexico, you know, your experiences are so very different depending on the show, the showrunners, the writers, the cast, you know, on every different show. Can you talk us through a little bit what it's like?
It sort of depends on how you're built, right? My father was a perfectionist as a writer. And I remember going into his office, you know, in the morning after he'd been up all night kind of pacing the halls with writer's block. Mm. And he wrote on a typewriter. And so you would see all these crumbled up pieces of paper, discarded scenes that were overflowing out of the trash can because he was never satisfied with the work. I think I developed that same sense of whether you call it
perfection.
A quest for perfection, which really is not built for television, as Colin, as you well know. Or it was a masochistic streak, or I don't know what it was, but it was always trying to do better and always trying to learn from each experience how to be a better storyteller, how to be better at understanding point of view. But it's, you know, it's the old art versus commerce conversation, right? Because there was a period of time in television, and this was actually before me, even as old as I am, where there was this huge syndication market, Magnum PI, and that show in syndication would sell for like $2 million a negative, or a million a negative, which really means just for the rights to re-air it, right? And that's where studios made their money. That's where the money came from, not from producing the show to begin with.
Syndication.
Right? It's something that doesn't really, I don't think it exists, in, at least not in that form anymore. And so as I came in, that was sort of dying out. And so all of a sudden, you know, they were tightening their purse strings because, well, if we can't be guaranteed so much money for syndication, then we're going to spend less. Up your backside about time and overtime and money. And yet you're trying to do the best job you can because you feel like you have a huge obligation, right? Someone is handing you, I don't know what it would have been then, let's say $2.5 million, $3 million worth of a product to realize, and you feel an obligation there, and you just want to do good work for good work's sake. You know, doing good work in anything, whether you're recording an album or whether you're doing batting practice or whether you're directing a TV show, takes longer. Good work just always takes longer. And so, you know, to reiterate the art versus commerce aspect of it, as a director, and I think in other jobs as well, cinematographer, composer, you have to sort of learn, like, where's the line? Like, how much can I push? How much can I go over in my hours or how many days and not get fired, but you're sort of forgiven because the work is good. And I think that's no different than it is today. And again, unless you have a gigantic smash like Euphoria, where probably money is no object, and maybe it is there too. But you know, even on Game of Thrones, money was an object, just as much of an object.
I want to make a quick introduction. Kevin Sharpley's joined this show, our director. I want to connect Kevin with Dan. I think he might have a question for Dan, because I know Kevin, who is based in Miami, is the biggest Miami Vice fan in the world. So this will be an interesting hello. Hi, Kev, how are you?
So, Dan, I mean, I've been looking forward to this. I was a little late. I have the baby by myself today. So it's made things a little bit challenging. But sorry I'm late. I've very much been looking forward to this because you've worked on some of my favorite shows and directed some of my favorite shows. And so my question is, I'm going to mention some of the shows. I mean, look, it would just take me forever to mention everything, but Miami Vice, True Detective, Game of Thrones, Servant, Lovecraft Country, Jack Ryan, Better Call Saul, The Leftovers, The Man in the High Castle, X-Files, NYPD Blue, Law & Order, all in my top favorites. My question is, I mean, there has to be a common thread amongst all of these shows. I know you mentioned that, you know, doing your best work, doing your best quality work, of which these, all the shows I mentioned are benchmark shows. I mean, all these shows have changed television history. What do you feel is a common thread amongst those projects?
Yes. Yeah, so what's the common thread? Really, I don't know that you could apply this to Law & Order, which was really, by the way, probably the first procedural in what, you know, soon became television, became kind of network TV, became known as the world of procedurals. And the reason that nobody bought the show originally, by the way, as a side note, is like, well, there's no real characters that we want to go home with. So I think it's I can't see it working or grabbing the audience.
Because we didn't deal with their home lives.
Yeah.
That was very strange.
Why initially CBS, Fox, CBS, and ABC all passed on the show. Sorry for that.
But you do, Dan, you do have this reputation as like the dark programming director god.
Yeah. Somehow I've gotten there, which is which is crazy because what I would really like to do is a comedy, but no one would trust me.
Yeah. But, you know, I just want to interject something because I mentioned that these are all changing. You know, a lot of these shows changed the genres. You mentioned Law and Order. That's right. There really wasn't true procedural before. And then you also talked about the metaverse, which is another game changing situation. So could that be a common thread that you've stepped into areas where you felt that it was a seismic shift, where it was a zeitgeist type of show?
So this sounds like a smart ass remark, but it really isn't meant to be. I get bored easily. And if you look at if you were to go back and look at my resume, you would see that I've never stayed on any show more than three seasons.
I noticed that.
Yeah, because after a fashion, I just want to do something else. I don't want to see another or direct another scene with a jury box. I don't want to direct another scene in an OR. And so my quest was to always look for things that felt different and challenging. And this sounds a little cliche, but do a deeper exploration of the human condition, of what makes us all humans, what makes us all vulnerable.
Is that something that you when you're going into something and let's say the possibility is there that it could go, do you think psychologically there's a point where you just go, right, well, I know I'm coming towards the end of my third season, I'm going to want to move? Or do you think there's ever a possibility where you would stay? It's a hypothetical question, I guess, but do you know what I mean? Or have you already sort of decided that?
You know, if it's an issue of authorship, if I have proprietary or a sense of ownership, my ownership, I don't necessarily mean financial ownership, you know, that it is a show that was developed, you know, through the auspices of myself and my partner, through our company, then more than likely, because I have a real investment in it and its success. But I don't know that I consciously ever go in saying after, you know, two seasons, I'm out of here. I just get restless. And I've often felt too, and I share this with young people, which is, you know, the list of young people is growing considering I've been at this a while. Every time that I have taken a risk in the business, not in crypto for sure, but every time that I've taken a risk, I have succeeded. It's scary to take risks, but I don't believe that you can grow as an artist. I'm not, by the way, necessarily referring to myself as an artist, but in general, believe that an artist can grow, or even someone who is, if you want to consider me a technician, I don't think you can grow and get better unless you're doing different things and you're telling different stories, right? If you're shooting House, for example, I really loved the job. I loved everybody there. I loved the stories. The scripts were great. Hugh Laurie was a pleasure to work with. Couldn't have been a friendlier environment. I made a lot of money. But here's the thing. If I do nothing but that, then I'm missing out on telling a story that's scary, or a story that is about, something that is more grounded to real life, you know, to stories of between fathers and sons, or, a sister and a mother, or I mean, that's kind of the cliche, obviously, but the truth is, I think so much of what we look for in stories is a certain degree of accessibility, right? That we want to understand what the characters are going through. We want to empathize with them, or we want to love to hate them. And I think those are born out of experiences that we have in our lives, either with family, friends, lovers, ex-lovers, etc. And I was also looking to sort of grow in terms of techniques that I could use to tell stories that obviously a place like HBO is much more open to, in terms of sort of a more cinematic approach narratively than house, as clever as it was, as open as it was.
But even, you know, when you look at Miami Vice, you look at True Detective, Lovecraft Country, which I hate is not going to have a second season, The Leftovers, The Man in the High Castle, all these shows also have very distinctive looks and feels. The music, the cinematography, you know, they are unique in a way that across the platform, the set design, the production design, across the platform, they are truly unique shows. And it seems that you connect on these time and time and time again. I mean, it's hard enough just getting one or two or and three. I mean, that's crazy.
Honestly, I can't really chalk it up to anything more than a hard sell when I meet producers, the creators, and sort of pitched myself for the shows back in the day. What has led me to some fortune in that regard, or good fortune, I should say, in that regard, is the fact that I think there's a lot of content. I think we would all agree, right? There's a lot of content now between, you know, back when I was a kid, there were three networks, and now there's four networks and endless choices for streamers and raw and basic cable. And so you need more content. And I think what I took very seriously was this idea of understanding how to tell a story that connected the audience on some emotional level to the characters, be it through point of view or choices in direction or what have you. And I've just always been a voracious learner. And I think it is my desire to keep learning, which is the thing that kind of ends up getting me bored with, you know, having done 62 episodes of House. Not that they're not great episodes, but I wanted to learn other things. And so I ask a lot of questions. I'm curious. And I find that a lot of newer, younger, they're sort of incurious. You know, this is a cool scene. I really like this. I want to shoot this like that. Yeah, okay. But what does it say to you? Like, why do you want to do it? What moves you? What's the note behind the note? You know what I mean? I think that curiosity, that interest, that desire to ask questions, that not being scared to tell somebody that I don't know the answer, and to not want to be the smartest person in the room has benefited me over time, and it's allowed me to become better at what I do, and it's made people want to hire me. I think that's the simple and yet complex answer.
It's so interesting listening to this conversation. The bravery that you have, because, you know, I'm a fan of Ricky Gervais, right? You're interested in comedy. Yeah. And I always wondered, you know, like, he was so brave in saying, I'm only doing three series of The Office. I'm only doing three series of Extras. It was like, wow, you're doing all this work. You're building these brands, these legacies, and then shutting the door and moving on to the next. And I just find it so interesting that this has been a pattern in your life. And I've always wanted to ask him why, you know, it's like, and for you to be describing, and it is because you're a creative genius, Dan. I mean, you really are, you know, from every aspect of filmmaking and storytelling. So to hear these answers, I just find so illuminating. Do you think that there, you know, there's a similarity between your decisions in exiting early to what Ricky Gervais does? Is there a similarity there?
First of all, when you show me in relationship to saying that I'm a brilliant genius, please make sure that my expression is what? Because I consider myself many things. I don't consider myself that. I do think that we all have a limited time on the planet. And I don't want to spend 8 years of it doing the same thing. And I think maybe it's that. I also think that there's just a real natural enthusiasm with figuring something out, right? For anyone who likes puzzles, writing music, God only knows, that's a puzzle. Writing a screenplay is a puzzle.
Yeah.
Figuring out how to create a style and a feeling for a show, a movie, you know, how to relay that narrative, that's a puzzle. And it's interesting to figure those things out. It's not really much of a puzzle after three seasons. Everybody knows after three seasons, if you're not a well-oiled machine and everybody just knows what it is and what's a house shot and what's not, then you're either the show's not working or you're not very smart. And I just didn't want to find myself in that position. I wanted to be somewhere where I wasn't bucking, the trend, but rather looking for something, something unexpected.
But truthfully, Dan, I mean, I find nowadays in television, with the crossover of film directors doing TV, they want to do either limited series or they want to do the pilot and the second thing and maybe the last episode. They don't want to sit with it, as you said, for its whole eternity or whatever it becomes. Because, as you said, they want to get on to the next creative thing. And one of the things you mentioned in your pre-interview, which a lot of people don't know, is the difference between television and film and then what we've got now, which is some kind of hybrid model. But where things have been categorized, where in theory, television was a showrunner's medium and film was a director's medium. And I think even that has changed now in the sense that there is more directorial vision on the screen with the vision we're watching now than there was maybe before. Like something like Law and Order, which yes, it was a groundbreaking procedural, but really shot in a very gritty way, which for television at the time, and I think you saw it in Miami Vice as well, but that was almost cinematic. It almost reflected it a New York indie film quality to it.
Totally.
And all the setups
Visual tone of it certainly did. You're right. And the idea behind Miami Vice always was for it to be big and cinematic. And even though Michael Mann didn't direct the pilot, he had a tremendous amount of influence on the style and trying to communicate the scope of it. And I'll tell you what also I think has affected this as a sidebar. I don't want you guys to run out of time, but you know, the advent of big flat screen televisions.
Yeah.
That's changed everything because you would get yelled at if you were doing any kind of a feature like tableau shot.
Right.
Right. For what? For a 23 inch screen. Once these screens became plentiful, that what the technology did in inverse was it gave the filmmakers and producers, writers, it gave them license now to be able to say, no, this is going to replace, or to some degree, it would cut into the audience for movies, and you have to be theatrical. And the term a few years ago, I remember going out pitching a project that I had, which did not sell. And I think in part because it was a more intimate story. And this was happening at the time that where Apple was about to premiere Apple Television, right? Apple Plus.
Yep.
And everybody was, the word in the business was big swings, big cinematic, you know, want to impress on a future audience how the risks we're taking, how risky and how controversial the subject matter will be, and how visually inspired it will be. So without the big screen TVs, that may never have happened.
Yeah. But we still, I think, you know, as much credit as we want to give to the streamers, I think that if I'm going, you know, me as a person and a creative, if I have to give credit to anybody, it would probably be HBO. Mm-hmm. I think that HBO is the game changer for all of us.
Yeah.
And their vision and what they were willing to spend on good writers and directors and just storytellers in general.
Yeah, no question about it.
So I got a quick question for you regarding music placement. And again, you know, you started off actually as a music supervisor as well as editing everything else you were doing. So your musical choices just fascinates me. I want to ask you about a song that you placed in Ozark, Natural Child by She's Got a Mind. Can you tell us a bit about that decision making, why you felt it fit the scene, and then let's listen to it.
She's Got a Mind by Natural Child, right?
Yes.
That one, yeah. I remember they had picked out something else, some hard rock song, and logically something that the girls would dance to, but I was really doing I was doing this montage that was intended to sort of do two things. It was narratively supposed to show the process by which money got laundered and how you would, you know, that part of the laundering process in a strip club, you know, and I think he referred to it as a family friendly business where a lot of cash is. but the lyric that kept getting to me was, you know, you were looking at a lot of flesh in that, a lot of bums and a lot of busts, and they kept repeating the lyric, "She's got a mind," and I just thought it was a funny play on it. But I mean, it's also like a really rocking song, and I can't remember where exactly I heard it. I heard it on the radio, and it was a couple of days before we shot the scene.
So your music supervisor didn't suggest it. This was something that you brought in.
She probably did suggest a bunch of things, but I just remember hearing this one and going in and saying, "Would you just to Jason say, would you listen to this and tell me what you think?" Just because I thought it would be spectacularly fun. But I mean, that is probably the exception to the rule that I would come in with something better than the music supervisor. And by the way, by better, not I meant something that excited me more.
I mean, honestly, I just love how that song kind of like personifies Ruth's, you know, the character's personality, and such a great choice of music. Dan, I was a fan before you came on the show. I think I've fallen in love with you now.
At least someone has. That's great. I'll take it.
I'm a fan.
I think we all have. I think we all have. And I think it's a great time to finish up and say thank you so much.
Oh, are we finishing, Colin? Is it over?
We're finishing. We are finishing, unfortunately. I feel like we've only just barely scratched the surface.
God, it's so true. We haven't talked about his NFTs, the work in his metaverse. We're going to have him back, Colin.
You guys have been great to tolerate me. It's a pleasure. Really.
It's been an absolute pleasure for us.
I love what you're doing with this, visually with this podcast. It's super cool. Really, really cool. And I wish you guys, all of you, all the best. And thanks for entertaining me and allowing me to ramble on, but I'm bummed, as it were.
Hey, guys.
Hey, Jace.
Hey, Jason. You okay?
Yeah, I'm good. Just buried in paperwork.
Oh, for the sync report.
Not this time. Move me no mountain.
That indie film you're music supervising?
Yeah.
Sounds like a great project. What's the problem?
It's a brilliant film and we're building a great soundtrack, but you can't imagine how much paperwork I deal with for these films.
Have you heard of Sync Lodge?
First, you got to draft up the sync request forms.
I've heard of Sync Lodge.
Then drafting and issuing contracts.
Yep, Sync Lodge is great, Paula. It does everything a music supervisor needs.
Then deliver the cue sheet. It never ends.
Doesn't Sync Lodge do all of that automatically?
Sweat Lodge? What are you guys banging on about? I got real issues I'm sharing with you guys.
Yeah, lots of issues.
We're trying to tell you, Jason. Sync Lodge is a new platform for music supervisors. It helps you to source the music, sync songs against scenes, draft up sync requests, and even creates the cue sheets once you've locked in the music to the film.
Oh, Sync Lodge does all that?
It's true, Jason. I just started using it for the sync report, and it's not only saving time, but it's so easy to use, I'm actually enjoying the work.
You guys are the best. Sync Lodge sounds amazing and exactly what I need for music supervising. Why am I always the last one to hear about these things?
I've been telling you about Sync Lodge for weeks.
Don't feel bad, Edge, for not telling me sooner. I know you're busy. You're a good guy.
Paula, is my mic on? Can you hear me?
Loud and clear, Edge.
Guys, what's the name of that program again?
Sync Lodge.
That is something to scream about. Yes, you too can be cool like Edge and use cutting edge technology to help you with your film and TV productions. No matter if you're a music supervisor, director, producer, editor, save time and increase proficiency with Sync Lodge.
I need to find a new gig.
Sync opportunities, sync opportunities.
So let's just say hello to everybody on this glorious stage. Andrew Rollins, how's it going, my friend?
It's going great.
You ready for tonight?
I'm ready.
You got your ears on? I need good music. So we can't be like saying to everyone, oh, it's good music. It's good. I need the perfect song for these placements. So I need you guys to be harsh.
Dude, I'm always harsh.
That's what Vinx, this is why we're never getting rid of you, because the honesty that pours out of you is insane. How's France going?
It's amazing, man.
Wait, are you in France right now? I see you're like in Penisville. What's that go? That statue, I need that in my backyard.
Yeah, I'll put in an offer for you.
Yes. If it's available, I will buy that.
It's perfect. We saw it. We had to stop. And then we went to a town. I hope I sent it to you. The name of the town was Negro Paliz. And I read it fast. I said, wait a minute. Let me back up. We had to go back to look at the town's name. And I promise you, I think I sent it to you.
Is that Negro Por Favor? Is
that what you're saying? That works
Kevin! Too. Where are you? Are you in Atlanta, Kev?
No. I'm on my way from upper west coast of Florida back down to Miami.
Oh, you're heading back home. You know, man's a legend. You know, you've just like completely stole the show for El Tada, this amazing AI convention. Even somebody that talks to you on a daily basis, you still fascinated me with the stories you were telling and the future of entertainment. It's so exciting. Let me welcome my music supervisor for Move Me No Mountain, the music director for 2 Cents Music, Dawn Johnson in the house. How's it going, woman?
Hello, Jason. I'm doing well. How's everybody? You guys have me laughing over here. You can't hear me, but the boys club at the beginning was fun.
Well, you know, you are always, the door is open to you, to Dawn, to join that boys club.
Yeah.
I know you can. You have the thick skin to put up with us.
I do. I traveled with men for the first 2 decades of my career. So.
Good. Well, then you're well broken in. And honestly, I am so excited. I see that you got your first contract through from Donovan and Pure Music.
Yes, we did.
So things are actually motoring along for Move Me No Mountain, I guess.
They are. Things are going. We're working on sync contracts. We've got all our sync requests going out. We're looking for a few more tracks here.
So, definitely. All right, Dawn. Should we just get into it?
Let's get into it. We have a band called 100 Meter Scream, and Gloria brought this track to us. She's, from what I know, she's...
G-L-O-R-I-A. Sorry.
She's helping manage them, but also a part of the band. I'm sure she'll tell us. She's here with Ralph, the bassist and vocalist, I believe. And here's the interesting thing. She came into my room with A Matter of Music on Friday. And when I heard the song, I was like, hey, I think I need to bring this over to the Sync Report. But she had already been in your room, so she found me. I don't know how that all happened. Anyway, let's listen to Total Escape.
So yeah, I got very excited about that because when I heard those guitars, it's so Where Is My Mind. It's very Pixies, but it's constant. It's a bit heavy. You know, again, the difference between an album track and a syncable track is something that has a bit more drama, a bit more flow to it that's going to kind of bring us up and bring us down. And, you know, you'd be able to have some voiceovers going over the music. Gloria, hello, Gloria. Say hello. Tell us who you are. Give us some information about that track and yourself.
Hi, how are you? So nice to see you.
G-L-O-R-I-A.
Gloria.
Tell us who you are. Give us a little background.
Well, I'm very kind of interesting. I'm a former emergency room doctor, so I'm done. Yeah, I just kind of got burnt out with this whole everything. So I've been doing music for a while, though, as a hobby. And now, you know, my partner, Ralph, which is part of 100 Meter Scream, he's a songwriter and vocalist and guitar. So we've been for several years now, and I write some lyrics and backups. So I thought this song would really fit pretty, you know. It was, I thought it was an interesting song, a little bit Eyes Wide Shut, a little creepy, you know, undertones. Yeah. So I brought it to Dawn when I saw the brief. So here we are. I have the.
Is this a new recording or is this something
that you recording you have? No, we had this about, I think this was done, Ralph, why don't you say, I'll introduce Ralph. He's a songwriter. He'll tell you the story.
Hi, Ralph.
Hey, how you doing, guys?
Good, good. Were you listening? Are you a Pixies fan when you
I love
this?
The Pixies. I love Frank Black. I love, you know, I love like the solo stuff. So I'm a...
Because your guitar pieces are gorgeous. I mean, that is just very Pixies.
Thank you. Yeah, yeah. I mean, the Pixies, you know, what can I tell you? They're just legendary. And by the way, I was hearing earlier when I was here with Gloria that someone was driving from the west coast of Florida into Miami. We're actually driving from Orlando to Miami. So we're not the only one. It's kind of ironic.
How funny. You guys got to stop and meet up with Kevin. That's my partner. That's the director of the show. I can hear him weighing in.
Yeah.
I'll pull off to the side and wait for you.
Oh, yeah. Well, maybe we'll meet at the center of the turnpike.
There you go. That's right.
Careful of the alligators.
Oh, yeah. That's Alligator Alley, actually. But, guys, this song, look, first of all, Gloria's been the saving grace. I mean, she came into this outfit. I mean, it's like, you know, everybody's got their story. I mean, we recorded this song, about 10 years. I mean, worked with a producer that worked with a Paramore, James Wisner, and he redid the, you know, the guitars and the vocals on this and Total Escape. But, you know, Gloria came in and kind of like she took command of 100 Meter Scream, kind of like she does in the ER, just organized everything. I mean, we were just in disarray. Two of the other original members in the band aren't in anymore because, you know, it's a tough business. And no, she always thought this song had something to it. You know, she thought that Total Escape had like kind of like that Kubrick kind of feel, kind of like, you know, and I guess what kind of topped in with the Pixies kind of guitar, I know it's maybe a little heavier than you know, most of the Pixie stuff.
I mean, that's the thing. I mean, would you be open to kind of opening up the track and, you know, playing with the mix on this thing?
Or? Yeah, listen, whatever you guys would like. I mean, it's fine. I mean, we're not opposed. Yeah.
Yeah, because it's so close to Where Is Your Mind. It's like, oh, we're so close.
Yeah.
In fact, I wish Milfredo was on stage right now. He would weigh in with his brilliant production notes. But I mean, talk about close. I mean, so fucking close to what we're looking for.
Yeah. Look, again, whatever you guys think would need to be done to, you know, accommodate the film, we're fine with that. But I'm just glad you guys like the song, and thank you for the Pixies compliment. And yeah, that's the highlight of my day there. Thank you.
Oh, fantastic. Well, look, let's see. Vinx, Andrew, do you guys want to weigh in on this track? I don't know if Vinx is a little bit out of your scope here.
I don't think anything's out of your scope, though,
to be honest.
You didn't think we listened to shit when I was in a suburban white high school?
I would just be impressed if you knew the Pixies. I would just be like, this
dude,
man knows
who do you
everything.
Think sold the dust to them kids? No, seriously. I love it. It's kind of, if I have to pick three words, I would say pungent, dainty, funk. Stank. Pungent, dainty, stank.
Oh, I love it. I love it. I think we've just coined a new phrase. That's brilliant. Thank you, Vinx. Andrew, I know that you had some thoughts on this. You're kind of close to this track. You know exactly what we're looking for.
Look, I thought that musically, I thought it was great. A little, still really a little too heavy, but, and vocally, way too heavy. But I think it's a great song. But, you know, the thing, as much success I've had in film and TV, you have to really immerse yourself into the character and not hit it directly. You know, don't hit the nail.
Yeah.
Don't hit the nail on the head, but make it so that whatever you say and lyrically, if you find that thing that you can bring the audience like right next to that person. You know, that's what you want to do.
That's the goal. That's exactly the goal. All right, Don, look, before we go on to the next track, we have a couple of people raising their hands. Let's see if they have questions. We bring people up and then they just don't have questions. They kind of just want to get on stage. Let's see if Astrid has a question pertaining to what we're doing here. Hi, Astrid. Long time. How you doing, lady?
I'm so fine. Thank you for getting me on stage, Jason.
Of course.
How are you?
I'm great. Well, I don't think we've had any submissions from you. This woman, I mean, look, what she does is more operatic, right? Am I right? Your vocals are so big and beautiful and classic. What a lovely treat to have you here on the stage.
Well, thank you so much. Yes, you're right. I'm an opera singer, but for now I have a dance track. And I send it to Dom, and it's called The Beginning of My Day, and it's completely different than you ever heard of me. Maybe it's a sing song, I don't know, but it could be.
How exciting. Astrid, then you just stay on stage with us. Once we get through Move Me No Mountain, we'll definitely play that track, okay?
Oh, I love you so much. And
I love you.
Yeah, and, I love you too.
Yes, yes, yes. But Don, let's get in. But who's next?
I'm going to pull a song out from Dusty, right? I see him.
Oh, my friend Dusty. Is Dusty in the room?
He is in the room, and I saw him
there. Oh, my God, that's amazing.
He sent us this track quite a while back, but I've known about it for a while. So when I saw him here, I thought, hey, I'm going to bring this track in. It's slower than what we've been hearing. I'm not sure if it's going to fit for the film. But since I saw him here, Dusty, like I said, I wanted to bring you in.
Dusty Wright, how are you, my friend?
I'm here. Can you hear me?
Hi, Dusty.
I'm sorry, guys. I'm driving. I had to drop my wife off at the train station.
You're getting rid of your wife. What's happened? A breakup?
You're so bad.
He has no comments.
He's like, get out of here, woman. Get on the train. You're out. All right, let's play Dusty's track, Don.
Let's go, Heather. Lonelyville.
Hill. I'm a star in love.
Is this off the new album?
Yeah, it's the title track off the new album. Yeah, thanks for playing it. I appreciate it, guys.
We're fans of yours. We love you, Dusty. You are one of my favorite artists that comes to this. You know, you're a dear friend of mine that precedes this entire concept. And you do. I love your music. I love your lyrics, especially. You know, what was the genesis of the song? Well, so your lyrics, they're beautiful, but a little painful. Very, you know, kind of, I feel, I relate to it.
The album is really incredibly introspective. And I think we were all going through COVID and had different mind games to deal with, contend with. And I was looking at this as, you know, all the office workers in New York who are stuck on, you know, the hill, being, you know, stuck inside a tower, an apartment tower, what have you, and not able to leave their apartments. And, you know, it started conjuring up imagery of this kind of concrete jungle and not being able to get out there and being the master of your own domain with no connection to the outside world, really, other than the endless news cycle and perhaps Zoom calls with friends and family. I'm feeling very much on edge about the whole thing, yeah. You know. I wanted to write, as I often do sometimes when I write these kind of maudlin lyrics, have it a very up-tempo song. And my friend Bobby Bird Burke, who lives in Woodstock, I did most of the tracking myself. And he goes, I can fly the drums and no worries. Get me the rhythm track and the bass and the click track that you created. Because I had created a drum track. I said, it doesn't have to be exactly like my drum track. So I loved his drum track, which made me then re-record the guitar and the bass to really match the energy. And it then brought the song, even though the lyrics are maudlin, it brought it up tempo. When I saw the Sync Report thing, I said, well, you know, it's a bit of a stretch, but it's more up tempo. I like I've always been a fan of the Pixies. I don't know if it's Pixie-like.
Kev, did you want to weigh in?
Yeah, I just wanted to jump in. I love the song, actually. You may not have been right for that particular sync, but for me, this exemplifies a syncable song. Because when I was listening to the song, you know, I could really hear, you know, for me, it was a relationship. So, you know, two people in a relationship, someone breaking up with the other person. But it would not overpower that scene, but it would add to the scene. It would add to the story and moving that story forward. So, and I could hear it in other scenes. The narrative of the song actually adds to what a specific scene would be, and the narrative of the song could add to a character. It is a thin line to walk, but for me, that song does it.
Thank you so very much. I really appreciate that. Much love to you.
Well, let's move into the NFTs. It seems like we got some submissions rolling in for the NFTs.
It seems that we do. Astrid, I got yours. I received yours. That was terrible grammar. I'm so sorry. Let's see. It's beginning of my day.
Every day, tomorrow a little more than yesterday. Say me what you want to say. Tomorrow is another day. It's the beginning of my day, my day, my day. Beginning of my day.
Wow, Astrid, what risks you're taking? How much fun is that track? That definitely is something that we can consider danceable. It's right in the pocket there. Astrid, why don't you give us a little background on that track?
Yeah, I'm working with DJ Marco Bergman. He is on the label of Armin van Buuren, a famous Dutch DJ. And he's a young DJ, very young man. We are really a team. We are working with each other for more than 10 years. He's living in London in UK. And yeah, we have daily contact and we're making tracks. I have 20 dance tracks because I love to sing dance music. It's the beginning of my day. I mean, it's really my voice. And you know my voice only like that voice.
No, it's nice to hear you stepping out of that comfort zone and trying this. It's lovely.
Yeah, I'm making a lot of hip hop and I'm going to record 3 tracks for a rapper called Donkey and another DJ from Long Island. He has made a track for me, so I'm going to record that next week also.
All right, well, that's excellent, Astrid. I'm blown away. I'm so proud of you and I'm so excited that you've submitted that. Thank you so much.
I could say it's perfect, actually. So that one has to go in the A list of tracks. Yeah, we could see Colin dance into that one. So
yeah, I could. So well, that is huge news because, of course, Kevin is one of the final decision makers on what song is going to be placed for this NFT. So Astrid, kudos to you. That is, I think it's one of the first going in the bag for the NFT.
Oh my God! It's 11:30 in the evening. I'm in my nightdress and I'm dancing. I'm jumping in my house. I'm getting excited now. Oh my God!
That's wonderful, Jason. We do have some others in the bag from previous shows, but
we don't know for sure. And then the final decision is going to be by Colin himself. But that definitely goes in a slot of songs that we're gonna at the top of the list. I'll put it to you that way.
Oh my God, I'm so grateful to be here. And I'm going to send some more, I promise you.
Yes, great, excellent. And we are grateful to have you, Astrid, thank you. What a way to close the show. Unbelievable, how much fun are we having in this room? Yeah, this just makes my entire week hanging out with you guys.
The Sync Report cast will be back in a week with your hosts, Rose Ganguza, Jason P. Rothberg, and me, Colin O'Donoghue. Until next time, take care and be kind.
Thank you for listening. Tune in next week.